Now, the climate wars in Australia have flared again, with the Nationals and Liberals arguing over whether the coalition should commit to the emissions target of net zero by 2050. International leaders have been gathering in Brazil for the annual UN Climate Change Summit, COP30, it's called, and this year marks 3 decades since global climate negotiations began. It opened with the UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, sounding the alarm.
We have failed to ensure we remain below 1.5 degrees. Science now tells us that the temporary overshoot between the 1.5 limit, starting at the latest in the early 2030s, is inevitable.
Yeah, every year when we hear from Antonio Guterres, his warnings get more dire. So what can be achieved at this summit? And what chance does Australia have of hosting next year's gathering? Let's talk to Nick Rowley, who's the chair of the New South Wales Net Zero Commission and a key figure in the drafting of the landmark Stern Review, which really concentrated minds about global warming when it was published in 2006. Nick Rowley, thanks very much for joining us on Saturday Extra.
It's a pleasure, Nick.
Let's start with the domestic news of the week before we talk about what's happening in Brazil. The Nationals have formally abandoned the commitment to reach net zero emissions by 2050, setting this challenge for the Liberals to follow. I mean, to what extent does this internal party debate matter in the sort of broader scheme of things at the moment?
Well, look, it's certainly not an evidence-based policy debate. Let me put it that way. I mean, I'd far rather a situation where you had the Nationals and the Liberals being as enthusiastic on net zero as they were as a few years ago. But what I would say is that this is a policy debate, or a political debate more than a policy debate. It's more about the symbolism than anything else. It's a debate around what might happen in 2050. I mean, many of your listeners will have been around in the year 2000 and think about debate 2000 about what the world is like in 2025. And these aren't really grounded debates in serious policy. And if you compare that to the situation here in New South Wales, where the legislation that helped establish the New South Wales Net Zero Commission, which I now chair, the New South Wales Parliament is often referred to as the bear pit, the very sort of crucible of contested, polarised politics, you could say. And yet the legislation which established the Net Zero Commission and committed to net zero here in Australia's largest state by 2050 didn't even go to a vote. There was such a measure of consensus driven by political leadership from people like Matt Keane from the right of politics and Penny Sharp, who's the current minister, who represents the Labour Party.
I mean, it has become this sort of symbolic issue, hasn't it? It has become this emblematic issue for the Liberals and Nationals. You get a sense it's actually really about whether they move rightwards to the sort of more populist right or stay where they are and sort of become in the moderate centre ground of Australian politics. The climate wars go on and on. I wonder how significant an impediment they have been in the transition towards more renewables. How much uncertainty have they created amongst the people who actually invest in solar and wind?
Well, if we look back over the past 10 years, it's a little bit like opening the door to a teenager's bedroom. It's a complete mess in terms of climate politics and policy, and you really want to go in there and fix it up, but then at periods during the Abbott governments and others, you sort of just want to close the door and just keep walking down the internal corridor. So, I mean, if you look at, I mean, I rather like the phrase from Martin Parkinson, who used to be head of Treasury and used to be head of Prime Ministers and Cabinet and has served Prime Ministers of left and right in Canberra, and he's written a beautiful piece which is simply saying that was the lost decade. There's been an enormous change, though, in Australia over the past few years. That has been driven by policy, that's been driven by technology. You now have more than 50% of the electricity generated in this part of the world coming from renewables. That's the situation now. If when I first started working on climate change back in 2000, when I advised the then New South Wales Premier, if somebody had told me that would be the case by now, I simply wouldn't have believed them. I mean, that's pretty much where we are. That's where the money is going. You asked about investment. If we just look at electricity generation, you've got more than $2 trillion US dollars globally going into renewables, and you've got a very small amount that is now going into coal. There's significantly larger amounts going into oil for other reasons, because, you know, oil is required for things like plastics and for other reasons. But you really have, this is no fashion, this is a very, very strong trend, and the adults in the room know it.
Let's switch from Canberra and the party rooms to Brazil and these international negotiations. I mean, the conference is being held in a place called Belém. It's an Amazonian town surrounded by towering rainforests. I mean, presumably there's a rich symbolism about the venue for COP30.
Oh, completely. I mean, merely by holding this event where it is, there's no way that the next two weeks or so are not going to have some element of response to help protect the forests that we have. And there's enormous symbolism in that. The meeting is likely to be about a little bit more than forests, but you know, that's no accident that it is in Belém. It's going to be very difficult to get the number of people who want to be in Belém into Belém. I fear that there'll be a lot of people who'll be having to pitch tents given the lack of accommodation. But nonetheless, it the way to think about these big COP meetings is really as focusing events. Each year they provide an opportunity to bring together three things: the problem, our understanding of that problem, what the science is, what the level of risk is, how we're travelling, together with the politics. And that politics, of course, is not just climate politics. It's also affected by other factors, including geopolitics, and then thinking about what the policy response will be. And it really is a moment when, like it or not, the ABC is going to be running news stories. We're going to be reading about what's happening in Belém, and it's going to be proclaimed in a rather false binary way as either a success or a failure.
We do view things in very binary terms. You're right. I mean, you mentioned there the geopolitics are missing from the lineup of leaders in Brazil. Four of the world's five most polluting economies: China, the United States, India, Russia. I mean, the US government hasn't even sent a sort of senior delegation. How much does that undermine the work that could be done in Brazil?
Well, it sort of takes it to a slightly lower level than some would say is required. But look, we are where we are in relation to the current incumbent in the United States. But, you know, just looking at the political theatre, and of course we have the grand political animator in the Oval Office at the moment, it's easy to just sort of forget some of the numbers and some of the data in terms of what is actually happening both globally but even domestically within the United States. Often cited is the wonderful example of, you know, an enormous economy, far larger economy than Australia's, in California, and loads of examples of how the whole clean energy transition is taking place there. But even if you look at states like Iowa, 60% of the electricity in Iowa comes from renewables. And if you look at states like Texas, almost 20% of US renewable energy supply comes from Texas. Now, the current president can huff and puff, but none of that is going to actually change. That's infrastructure that has been invested in that is producing low emissions energy and is doing it at a lower cost.
Yeah, a key point that was obvious in Trump 1.0 was a lot of stuff was happening at the state level despite what was happening in Washington. Yeah. Let's talk about Australia's prospects for hosting next year's COP event. Do we know where the Australian bid is?
I don't. I think it's going to be messy. It will be resolved. I don't know what the outcome is going to be. I think that there are enormous opportunities for Australia in hosting this event next year. There are risks. There are risks as well. The main risk is simply time. These major international meetings, Nick, as you know, take an enormous amount of preparation, and it's only going to be a year. And having been involved in helping advise in relation to how one put climate policy response on the agenda of a G8, it just is going to take an enormous amount of work to get the most value out of this meeting for Australia and indeed for the world in less than 12 months.
You're dating yourself there, Nick, by talking about the G8. That was, of course, when Russia was involved. They're not involved anymore. It has been great to talk to you. We should say, of course, Australia's up against Turkey in its bid. It wants to hold it down in Adelaide. We will bring you news of whether Australia's bid is successful or not. Nick Rowley, it has been great to talk to you. You're a former climate advisor to the former UK Prime Minister, Tony Blair, and you are now the chair of the New South Wales Net Zero Commission. Thanks for joining us on Saturday Extra.
Absolute pleasure, Nick. Thank you.
ABC RN helps you understand the world. Find more of our stories on the ABC Listen app.